capitalism doesn't seem to be working all that well for the majority of people, not just economically, but psychologically as well. Could the commons replace it?
The tightening noose of neoliberal capitalism is forcing us into very constricted roles as consumers or employees or simply participants in markets. When people want to have a human identity that's much broader than market culture and norms.
That's commons activist and author David Bollier. This week, he returns to Writer's Voice to talk about the newly updated edition of his groundbreaking book, Think Like a Commoner. Bollier reveals why the commons, a way of meeting needs beyond the market and the state, is more vital than ever in an age of ecological crisis, corporate concentration, and rising authoritarianism. In a fascinating conversation, we explore how commoning works, why it matters, and how it could transform our future. This is Writer's Voice, compelling conversations with authors who challenge, inspire, and inform. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. It was 10 years ago that we first spoke with David Bollier about his book, Think Like a Commoner, A Short Introduction to the Life of the Commons. Now, in a return appearance, he tells us about the book's newly updated edition. Bollier argues that the commons are neither relics of the past nor utopian fantasies. They're living, adaptive systems that help people meet needs through cooperation, rather than competition. In our conversation, he tells us why the commons movement is growing worldwide, how it provides a survival strategy amid climate breakdown and political turmoil, and the practical ways communities are creating commons today, from urban housing to open source software. Bollier also shares how thinking like a commoner challenges deeply held assumptions about property, law, and power, and why storytelling and culture are key to this transformation. Let's listen now. David Bollier, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
It's great to be back.
It's been at least a decade, I'd say, since we talked to you about the first edition of this book, Think Like a Commoner. Why did you feel it needed an update?
Well, it was triggered when some people in Thailand asked if they could do a translation of the first edition. And I said, of course, that I'd be thrilled. But then I went back and started to read it again for the first time in many years. And I said, this is feeling a little stale. A lot of things have happened. My own perspectives on the commons had evolved and changed through my various adventures. And I asked my publisher, and he said, oh, we'd love to. The inventory of the first edition is almost out. Let's do it. So I spent many months rethinking what needed to be changed, and I found there were lots of topics that I had given minimal treatment to before, like localism, like commons and their interactions with the state and law, like commons as a relational social organism as opposed to a resource. And I said, you know, I got to change all this. And so I spent several months doing it, and voila, I came out with the second edition. It was released in March of this year.
When you say we need to think like a commoner, what does that actually mean?
Well, you know, most people, when they talk about the commons, regard it as this archaic relic of medieval times, or they talk about the oceans or the internet as commons as if it's just a resource. But in fact, a commons is a living collective social organism for getting stuff done. And it's a sector of meeting needs that is quite separate from either the state or markets, especially capitalist markets. And so it has a different ethic. It has a different set of social practices. It has a different type of order that it strives for. And it's kind of a worldview, ultimately, a way that a group of people can create their own intersubjective cultural realities. And I think that this is what has sustained commons throughout millennia in human history as probably the default way of meeting needs.
So when you say it's a living generative system. How does a shift to that kind of thinking change how we think about power, ownership, and community?
Well, that's the thing about the commons, is once you start to pull on one of these threads, a lot of other threads start to unravel too. So if you start to talk about relationality among yourselves as the core reality you're trying to enact, you start to realize that private property is working at different purposes, and that's the basis for capitalism. And bilateral contracts, similarly, it presumes that you can write it, put in writing some agreement between you, and that's everything. When in fact you find that in nature and in human collectives, it's a far more complex, intersubjective, not just, you know, something you can put in legal language. And it becomes kind of a way of living. And it also allows a broader amplitude of human behaviors and attitudes to manifest, instead of all of us just being, you know, as economists would say, selfish, utility-maximizing materialists. You can have a much broader array of human behaviors that are not just nice or interesting, but actually functionally important for getting stuff done. And that's sort of what the commons is all about.
So give us an example of that.
Well, I suppose you could look at a lot of, you know, traditional or indigenous communities, which are maybe the purest examples of people getting together and creating their own peer governance as a way of meeting needs. But it's also quite modern in things like open source software communities or many other types of digital communities, where people voluntarily, collectively come together to figure out what their shared purpose is, what diverse talents they bring to the table, how they can organize those talents to produce, whether it's a software program or platform, whether it's a knowledge sharing commons for a scientific discipline, or many other types of collaborative activity for creating useful stuff. So that's the basic paradigm.
You mentioned that the commons has been seen as a historical curiosity, but you've been writing and working on this issue of the commons over more than a decade, well more than a decade. It's a movement that's grown. What do you think are some of the main catalysts for the growth of the idea of the commons?
Well, I think in the big picture, the internet, by providing this enabling infrastructure, and then a lot of other software platforms that helped push that along, whether it was open source programs or wikis, which led to Wikipedia and dozens of other wikis, or the blogosphere or other social media, that has opened up a lot of horizontal relational collaboration. Of course, the corporate world has taken notice and has tried to co-opt it or control it, which is a major source of struggle. But so the internet is one area. I think the other is the tightening noose of neoliberal capitalism, which is forcing us into very constricted roles as consumers or employees or simply participants in markets. When people want to have a human identity that's much broader than market culture and norms, especially if it's not going to be profitable. So I think people are reacting to that as well. And then certain regions of the world are, I think, more advanced or accepting of commons, whether it's the Global South, which historically has been based on a lot of commons activity, or Europe, which is a kind of a hotbed, especially European cities like Barcelona or Amsterdam or many other provincial cities in Europe.
Give us some examples of what's happening in Barcelona and Amsterdam.
Well, years ago, a activist movement of housing activists, one of their leaders became the mayor of Barcelona. And she entered city government with a very different vision of what it should do. So they hosted and facilitated such things as city support for neighborhood commons, taking over buildings that were derelict, inviting the neighborhood to help renovate them and manage them. They helped initiate some local currencies. They had knowledge sharing about civic information and what's going on in the city. They've developed elder care and child care commons, where people come together to provide service with the assistance of the city. So instead of a bureaucratic command and control situation where we're the state, we know what's best, they were collaborating with self-organized neighborhoods or citizen groups to meet needs in more customized, flexible, and ultimately humane ways. And I might add, it also saves money for the city by leveraging people's creativity and talent instead of just having expert professionals do everything.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned housing because we've just seen a political earthquake happen in New York City where Zohran Mamdani, a Democratic socialist, has won the Democratic nomination. And he's talking about things like city-run grocery stores. You know, he's talking about free buses. Does that fit within the concept of the commons?
Well, some things like that will, if they're run by the city, will have a different flavor because they'll be top-down, albeit for the people. Whereas commons, to be quite precise about it, is self-organized from the bottom up according to the terms and needs of those people. Having said that, there's all sorts of so-called commons public partnerships that are being experimented with in many European cities. There's no typology or even best practices yet, but a lot of really interesting examples that leverage what the state can bring in terms of legal support, technical support, even money, and then what people can do in terms of knowing their neighborhood better than some bureaucrat, you know, miles away, and knowing what they need and how they might want to meet those needs. So there's a conversation that Commons Public Partnerships invites that I would hope that the new mayor would embrace and experiment with himself, because there's a lot of upside for getting people reconnected civically to each other, to feeling that they have some measure of self-determination in their lives.
You describe the commons as a parallel polis. So how can it work, a polis being really a political kind of entity, like a parallel government or islands of coherence that are outside of the market state system? How does that actually work to have these partnerships in a way that can preserve that bottom-up power?
Well, I mean, that's an excellent question, because historically, a lot of efforts to work, find change by working within the system has been co-opted or neutralized. And the whole idea is that Vaclav Havel, the cultural dissident in the 1970s before he became president of the Czech Republic, was asked, well, how do you deal with a totalizing system that's not open to rational persuasion or civic action? And he said, well, you need to build a horizontal parallel polis of relationships that prefigure the kind of social order and economy you want, and that allows you to speak the truth without self-censorship or co-optation. And I think that's what the commons verse, as I call it, is. A lot of projects that collaborate horizontally outside of conventional markets and state control, that assert their own sovereignty in a social and civic sense. And then I think once that level of organization has occurred, you can start to have a more fruitful negotiation with the state, because the state realizes you can get stuff done. And moreover, you can do it in a trustworthy way, which a lot of state bodies or politicians can't claim. So I see this as partly political, but partly about building a new order based on terms congenial to us, as opposed to some politician who has his own ulterior agenda or constituents that, you know, perhaps thrive on fear or othering of people. You know, can we have a different kind of tone and agenda by developing a new political order through the commons?
Well, David Bollier, you know, thinking like a commoner, just following the title of your book, Think Like a Commoner, it strikes me, we're in a time of, I wouldn't even say creeping fascism. I think we're moving very, very quickly in this country. Of course, you're talking on a global scale, but you and I both live in the United States. How do you envision the commons movement grappling with the increasing the increasing atmosphere and actual operation of repression?
Well, you know, I can't say that my book deals with that, and I haven't fully come to terms with how it does either. But I will say this, commons are a survival mechanism. We saw during the pandemic that mutual aid networks were indispensable for many people. And I think it's a way of retaining our humanity while doing stuff that matters to people in a survival sense. More than that, I think there are all sorts of commons we can create, which allows us to not depend on predatory market or state systems. We can meet our needs directly through collective action, and we don't have to be subservient to a state that is making all sorts of unreasonable demands on us, or to a global corporate order that is shaking us down at every turn because they have so much capital. So I see the commons as really being the seedbed for keeping alive many things, many types of freedoms that are important to us when the state and its corporate allies are not so interested in that.
It's interesting you say that. I was on a webinar the other day, which was a training in non-cooperation with authoritarianism. And it strikes me that the commons is a form of non-cooperation. It's independent action.
Well, I love the history of when Linux, the open source computing operating system, was first launched. It sent Microsoft and other big tech players apoplectic because they realized it was a meeting of needs outside of control that they had. It was a withdrawing of being dependent. And I think that that is an important signal because it not only reduces the power of corporate players in that sense, it also is a moral indictment of the existing system. It shows that there's another way to do things that doesn't depend on the very narrow way of corporate-approved solutions. And opening those vistas, opening that imagination is going to be key to overcoming whatever fascism we have to deal with. We cannot just get into the harness, the control of those ruling systems. We have to have our own sovereign vision and imagination, and I might add courage, but not in just simply performative ways, but in ways that are meeting our needs, because we do have needs that have to be met.
So let's talk more about the thinking like a commoner as a new way of being, as a worldview, as a way of operation in one's daily life. I think there's a lot of cynicism for people who have grown up under capitalism about, quote, human nature. And the idea is that inevitably people are going to be greedy, there are going to be conflicts, people are going to try to take advantage of a system. The operation of the commons, what kinds of mechanisms are put into place, what kind of infrastructure is necessary to encourage the best behavior and discourage the worst?
Well, first of all, your question requires that we deal with this smear that has afflicted the commons for years, the so-called tragedy of the commons, which assumes that everybody is an individual out for themselves person who's going to grab as much as they can and screw everyone else. This is the idea that Garrett Hardin outlined in his 1968 essay, The Tragedy of the Commons, which said, imagine you have a pasture and you can put your cattle on, as many cattle on it as you want, and take as much from it. This will lead to overexploitation and ruin of the commons. Well, he was not describing a commons which has governance, rules, punishment for people who break the rules, prohibitions on outsiders taking things if they haven't contributed to the commons. And so he was describing, ironically enough, the market, the tragedy of the market, which has no rules, which allows people laissez-faire style to take as much as they want. So a commons has built-in mechanisms to prevent unfair appropriation or coercive appropriation, whether through the social norms and people monitoring how the resource is being used, or through legal protections, or through some in digital context, through digital technological protections of keeping something as commonwealth and not just something that can be a free-for-all that everybody can just take as much as they want. So, I mean, that's really part of the paradigm of the commons is it has its own way of protecting itself from hostile outside forces for the benefit of those stewarding the shared wealth.
Can you give some examples?
Well, the classic, you know, is, of course, land. Well, you could talk about land or forests or fisheries or irrigation water. Those things may be naturally occurring, but sometimes they need to be stewarded to prevent over-exploitation of them or to allow the water from a river to irrigate some farmland. Well, the people who contribute to making those things possible are the ones who should be most entitled to using it. They don't treat it as strict private property the way a capitalist might, but as something that is a gift of nature that has to be carefully stewarded so that it will be replenished. And especially since their everyday lives are often dependent on it, they are serious about that proposition, about preventing the free riders from taking too much. But you can see the idea of protecting the shared wealth in not just natural resources, but in the urban commons I mentioned earlier, where people who contribute to childcare or elder care commons, or who contribute to a community garden, or participate in a community-supported agriculture farm, those people who contribute are due certain entitlements, and they, of course, want to protect the general wealth from being overexploited. So those are, you know, kind of examples. When you have things like digital software, it's not depleted when it's used. It's actually the value is enhanced as more people contribute to it. So you don't have to protect it. What you do have to do is guard it against people who might vandalize it or take it for or somehow introduce bugs or be mischievous. So there's a different challenge for resources that aren't used up with use, like code.
You know, I'm going to pose to you a situation which I know about here, and it's really a conundrum. I live on the east end of Long Island, and you have a fishing community in Montauk that is under a tremendous amount of pressure because there are fewer and fewer fish in the sea. It's harder and harder to fish. And so rather than protecting the commons of the ocean, these fishermen are all in competition with each other and try to get as much fish as they can. And they are the angriest at the government, which is putting limits on the amount of fish that they can take out of the ocean in order to ensure that fishing stocks, you know, remain for the future. I mean, this is the classic case. How would the commons approach a situation where the fishermen don't want any kind of regulations because, in fact, they're under so much economic pressure as it is?
Well, that challenge has been encountered in many other marine circumstances. But I think the answer to it is, even if government got out of the picture, those fishermen would not be in good shape because they would ultimately deplete whatever fish remain. The point is some self-governance and limits are necessary. To the extent that the state is not prepared to do what's necessary, because many of their interventions allow over-exploitation as well, places like Maine and their lobster fishermen use a commons where you have designated people and families who are allowed to participate, and they self-govern themselves and protect the lobster stock by assuring that no single fisherman overtakes what can be sustained. And this has the advantage of lobster fishermen not being resentful at others, but taking responsibility themselves and trying to do this from the outside as a government force with legalistic rules and unlimited enforcement capabilities is really difficult. But I think a self-governed and managed lobster commons does work, has been shown to work. And I think a lot of this also requires that you deal with the industrial players, the industrial fishing trawlers that just take huge nets and sweep it all up. They have no commitment to the coastline, to the community, to the longevity of the fishery. And so you need to take action against those who are really depleting it, not the small fishermen who are really at the lowest end of the pecking order and have very few powers and have legitimate concerns about their livelihood. I think coastal fishery commons really has a long-term answer because it invites the fishermen to become synergistically responsible for the fishery as opposed to just displacing the problems onto the government, onto other people, and forcing them to develop their own culture of governance of that fishery.
That makes sense. So, David Bollier, in Think Like a Commoner, do you have examples of people, of commons, that have actually been able to reclaim the common space from the market, from private enterprise?
That's a really hard proposition because once a market player, often a large corporation, uses its market power and capital to privatize and commoditize a shared wealth, it's often very hard to get it back. I think of something like couch surfing, which for some of you may recall was a travel hospitality gift economy where you could travel somewhere and stay on someone's couch. It was a social occasion. It was free. At a certain point, they needed money to take care of their servers and deal with the volume of people they had using the service. And they took venture capital money, and the venture capitalist essentially turned it into a travel marketplace service. And it changed the character and ethic of the whole thing. And essentially, couch surfing is gone as a gift economy. I think there are things that have to happen for commons to protect themselves in the first place, such as state support, types of finance that don't require them to become market players, and even a cultural awareness of how they have to adopt certain social practices and behaviors to protect their commons affirmatively. But there are instances where people, especially in digital spaces, because you don't have the same, let's say, barriers to creating the commons, have created infrastructures like cloud computing systems, where there's an infrastructure that people can use to make commoning easier and more normal. And you can essentially maneuver and do an end run around the corporate players. Of course, that takes a lot of work. It's not easy to create a commons-based competitor to X, formerly Twitter, or Blue Sky, because it's so much capital is needed to create some of these enterprises. But I think it is more accessible, more feasible for that to happen in digital spaces than many others. And there are many robust commons in the digital spaces to this day. It's a harder proposition in biophysical spaces, forests, fisheries, farmland, without state help or without instruments like community land trust finance and that whole movement to help engineer it, because it requires, you know, acquiring land. That's expensive. Requires organizing a bunch of people in a local space to support that. So, you know, this is part of the challenge to reclaiming the commons.
I know that you've been working over the years on international legal frameworks for the commons. It seems that that would be pretty important to be able to reclaim the commons in a world in which private capital is privatizing just about everything we can see.
I think that for the near term, the most promising strategies are what I call legal hacks, meaning like software hacks that use the system to do something it wasn't intended to do that serves your collective interest. A legal hack is something like the Creative Commons licenses, which are a license that a copyright owner can affix to their work to say, this can be used without permission or payment in advance because I put this symbol, this logo on my work. It's essentially a license to share. And I think that we see similar legal hacks with something like rights to nature, where because Western jurisprudence is so designed to serve capital and market interests, it's hard for nature to protect itself against being treated as a free resource or as a free waste dump. So there's been movements in dozens of countries and even many states and municipalities in the U.S. to assign legal personhood to nature so that nature can be represented in any legal proceedings to protect itself. That's a kind of legal hack that, you know, it doesn't fully address indigenous people's concerns that it's still Western jurisprudence that's governing, but it does create an opening for starting to have a new conversation and to try to take it further. So I think those are the kinds of strategies that some people are exploring these days of taking existing law and with creative, clever twists, making it serve other interests such as nature or sharing.
Commons activist and author David Bollier talking with us about the revised and updated version of his book, Think Like a Commoner. Stay tuned for more of our conversation after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Go to writersvoice.net to listen again, like, and subscribe to the podcast. Let's get back to my conversation with David Bollier about the second edition of his groundbreaking book, Think Like a Commoner. So you said that's in the short term. What would you envision for a more medium or long-term form of jurisprudence? How would the ideal jurisprudence that protected the commons work?
Well, I think part of the problem is that Western jurisprudence is kind of the default norm around the world, at least for the commercial and capitalist world. And it's so insinuated into the way state power is structured and its goals and purposes. There's such a deep alliance between capital and the state that really you need some serious reconfiguration of the state to delegate powers to commoners the way, in some cases, they've done for indigenous people by allowing indigenous people's governance and law to prevail in that regime, that territory. And I think long-term, this is a proposition about reconfiguring state law, state power and state law, which, given the state of the world, is not likely to happen in the next few years. But I think there's enough dissenting voices being heard that the existing system is, especially in its depletion of the environment and climate change issues, has to change in some ways to recognize these collective interests affirmatively and not just by accident and not just by using existing bodies of law like, say, co-op law or limited liability partnerships, neither of which are intended to support commons. Some people have made them support commons in very workaround ways. So that's a big structural problem that I don't frankly have an answer to right now. We have to do what we can right now.
You mentioned the depleting of the environment. I think we're at the space where the global economy is eating up three times the resources of the actual planet that we live on. Talk about growth, self-sufficiency. There are also movements for degrowth. How does the commons fit into that whole rubric?
Well, I think that things like degrowth or donut economics, some of your viewers may have heard, which is about putting a limit on what is consumed from the earth, are really important macro analyses and frameworks. What I think is often missing is, how does this work in my local circumstances, in my household? How do we enact that? And I think that the commons has a deep affinity to those larger macro analyses by providing a set of social practices and an ethic for sufficiency and not for endless consumerism and growth. So I think that commons are a way that we can, in the on-the-ground level, through our own cultural priorities and practices, enact degrowth. You know, degrowth sounds kind of ridiculous to Americans because we're so weaned on the growth vision as the only one possible. But in Europe and the global South, the idea of degrowth, which I should clarify is not simply contraction of the economy, but a reallocation of what we produce so it's meeting everyone's needs and not just the wealthy. Because we can meet most needs with our existing economy. It's just that it's grossly misallocated. So to the extent that degrowth gets us into a path for addressing inequality, for meeting needs in a more humane, ecological ways, I think the commons has a lot to contribute because there's already many existing examples. It's not just visionary or utopian. It's happening right now. It's just not culturally legible. It's just the mainstream press is not talking about it. Even mainstream political parties and NGOs have trouble embracing it because their identities, their franchises are based on a different politics, a different economic vision.
What role do you see the commons playing in addressing something like the increasing dominance of AI? Because AI is almost the apotheosis of the concentration of power, at least as it's being used now. And we've been talking a lot about a digital commons. How does that fit in?
Well, that's a great question, and I've circled that question from many different angles, and I frankly don't have an answer because it is so concentrated on the big tech owners of big databases, and the amount of capital and energy simply to run those systems is enormous. So I don't see a commons arising anytime soon except in officially approved apps that the AI big tech people produce. But even having said that, AI systems are both super derivative of what has preceded in the past and do not have the kind of human agency, creativity, or judgment that we real-life humans do have. And on top of that, AI systems are making a bid for their own recognition of personhood, where people are starting to have online lovers in AI, and they're starting to be regarded as oracles or companions and not just tools that we master. And I'm very fearful of that evolution, particularly since the tech will be designed to maximize profits and commercial potential. And finding a way into that to have mutualized benefit under certain social controls seems totally off the table right now. And certainly the government is not doing much in that regard. So I'm afraid I have a pessimistic answer on that for now, except that I do believe in the human spirit and its artistic capacity to subvert or bypass or otherwise call to account the predations of AI that are yet to come.
Yeah. So tell us, how important is storytelling? I mean, you talk about storytelling in Thinking Like a Commoner. In building that commons culture, in building the kind of resilience or even resistance to the ever-increasing power of these oligarchs.
Well, I think that that actually might be a little secret weapon that commoners have, because if you think of arts and culture as the way we tell stories, that's accessible to us all the time. And that starts to knit us together as a cultural collective in ways that just white papers or politics doesn't necessarily do. You think of the music of the 1960s, which was so subliminally speaking to what people were feeling. I think that arts and culture in all its forms is a way for us to express our common concerns and to start to work with that, to build on it. And of course, storytelling is part of arts and culture as well, especially the performance arts. So it's maybe premature to say this, but I see that there's an uptick in arts and culture addressing some of these issues in ways that the intellectuals have not necessarily done, or done with as much cultural power as artists can do. So that's where I look for some hope of people like performers and playwrights. There's a huge array of musicians that are speaking to these issues. And then you're starting to see artists get together to try to reclaim their artistic integrity and freedoms in ways that the commercial world doesn't allow, and sometimes the state is now disallowing. So I see the commons as a way to frame this discussion and give a validated space to these outside players who are correctly disillusioned with the way the state and corporate markets now work.
This is Writer's Voice, and I'm Francesca Rhiannon. I'm talking with commons activist and author David Bollier about the revised and updated version of his book, Think Like a Commoner, A Short Introduction to the Life of the Commons. Now, finally, I've noticed that you have become, I don't know when this happened, you've become the director of Reinventing the Commons program at the Schumacher Center for A New Economics. Tell us what you do there.
Yeah, well, that's for many years prior to that, I was working, let's just say, as a independent scholar and activist with numerous international players and domestic players. But since 2017, I've been associated with the Schumacher Center for New Economics in Great Barrington, Massachusetts, as the director of their Reinventing the Commons program. And this is a base from which I maintain lots of conversations and strategic alliances to help move things forward. There's some friends of mine in London and Europe who are big into post-capitalist textile growing and fashion on a bioregional basis, trying to reimagine the, you know, wasteful, ecologically degrading fashion industry by thinking how we can grow textiles locally, avoid the fast fashion global supply chains, which are so destructive, et cetera, et cetera. So I advise people like that. I talk to others who have interesting ideas and try to advance the commons perspective in them. So that's what I do with the Schumacher Center for New Economics. There's a huge surge of bioregional activity going on these days, which I think is really needs to be supported, and we need to pour ourselves into that framework for reimagining the economy.
So what do you mean by that, reimagining a bioregional economy? I mean, how would that work?
Well, there's a number of, what shall I say, key activists or centers. A fellow named Joe Brewer, who's been active in the Global South, who has become something of an organizer among many bioregions of the U.S. Cascadia, which is the Pacific Northwest bioregion, has, after some slumbers for many decades, in recent years has become far more active and recently hosted a major conference on its bioregion, how to rethink how the Pacific Northwest can re-engineer its economy in a more self-sufficient bioregional way. But there is a bioregional learning center in England, which is a catalyst and convener for many of these conversations. And there's the Bioregional Weaving Lab in the Netherlands that is helping to organize a lot of bioregions in Europe. The point is, people are correctly seeing that they need to reground our economy and cultural identities in the bioregion if we're going to get a grip on some of the ecological problems we face. And I think this is a really encouraging sign. It's very early to say how it's going to evolve, but it has roots in the 70s and 80s that are now blossoming again. So I'm very encouraged by these developments.
Well, that's so interesting. And I, of course, totally agree with that. But it does come into conflict with the idea of comparative advantage. I mean, there's certain things you can never do here. You know, it will call into question a lot of our, say, clean energy technology, because it depends on global supply chains. So do you envision some kind of more just way of integrating a global economy with local bioregions?
Well, it means that you don't get all your meat from Australia, and you try to grow things more locally. You try to develop interdependent regional economic suppliers for your needs, whether it's housing or furniture or food and the other things we need. The point is, you don't see the entire globe as your source material, which is going to be either not economic or fragile and brittle, because it's very difficult and expensive to maintain these global supply chains, especially as climate disasters get worse and energy costs get higher. So being regionally and locally self-sufficient and resilient will be a huge priority in the coming years as climate disasters bear down on us. And we need to be prepared. We need to start reframing ourselves as regionally helpful to each other, as opposed to, oh, I'm just going to buy it on the market from Home Depot. That'll bring it from China. Well, you know, a lot of that's just going to go away or it's going to collapse. So the bioregional movement is trying to preemptively address that.
But even the iPhone depends on...
Well, I think world commerce is still going to happen, of course. It's not going to make a bioregion utterly self-sufficient. But I think the direction it needs to go is that way. I think there needs to be more technology transfer. There's a whole movement called cosmo-local production, which consists of design and knowledge being shared globally, open source style, but then things being produced locally, from houses to furniture to motor vehicles to, one of my favorite examples is parents who created a automatic insulin delivery device for their diabetic children along with an iPhone app. I mean, it's something the medical device industry was not offering or innovating. It, for me, it's an example of how all sorts of needs can be designed and met through this kind of creative cosmo-local production, cutting out the supply chains. Of course, there's going to be all sorts of technologies that we can't substitute, and I'm not sure what we do about that, but the general directionality is going to have to be to more self-sufficient, self-reliant bioregion economies without the supply chains that are so overdeveloped and expensive right now. We're going to have some issues we're going to have to deal with, to be sure. And this is, I think, part of the price of stepping out of the glam modern economy we've become so acclimated to, especially as Americans, who overconsume the rest of the world by many times. So, you know, it's not necessarily going to be deprivation. I think it could be liberation into, let's just say, not as materially dependent consumption, that maybe relationships and groundedness will be in some ways a liberation from the frenzy and debt and material glut that we live with. So yes, the culture will change. It's unclear how exactly.
Well, it is all explored in the second and new edition of Think Like a Commoner. David Bollier, it's just been great to talk with you about this book.
Thank you so much for such great questions.
David Bollier. Go to writersvoice.net to find out more about Bollier's work and the Commons movement. You can also find links to our other conversations with him about commoning, battles over copyright law, and more. Song about Palestine by Muhammad al-Mukit. I want to share something with you that happened to me today. But to set it up, I first want to play this clip from my interview with Omar El-Akkad from earlier this year. You point out also other rights that are being eroded in this way. For example, you know, the right for people to decide whether they're going to boycott a product from Israel. So talk about, you know how that has developed as well, the forbidding of people being able to exercise the First Amendment rights.
Yeah, I mean, I think that one of the most dangerous things we've decided to allow as a society, and I say we in the grandest possible sense, many, many people have stood up to this sort of thing, and nonetheless, it has happened anyway, is this fantasy that all of these moments in which we strip ourselves of rights, in which we sort of limit freedom of expression, in which we limit freedom to protest, freedom of dissent, all of these things that in the national mythology we hold up in the highest regard, that it's going to remain temporary and that it's only going to apply to a certain subset of human beings that we already consider subhuman, so who cares, let's do this. And it's never that. Even if it was just that, it would make it no less evil. But it never is. The light armored vehicles that I saw in Afghanistan with the machine gun turret on top that I'm sure killed countless of Afghanistani folks who got too close, I saw them again in Ferguson, Missouri. And it shouldn't be the case that I'm presenting it this way, right? Because effectively what I'm saying is, yeah, the bad thing happened to people who don't matter, but you better be careful because soon they'll matter. They'll happen to people who matter. And I understand that that is a construction from within the heart of the empire that shows you the kind of person I am. But it's nonetheless a function of countering the central lie we tell ourselves, which is the bad thing is just happening to those people over there and it will stay in those confines. It never will. It never will. And so you see all of these new, you know, legislation, these new rules being passed, these new punishments being handed out. And some of them are on their face absurd. You can try very hard to punish someone for something they don't do or something they don't buy, but it's an increasingly difficult thing. And if you think that it's being applied in this one case and that'll be the end of it, and certainly recent history has some bad news.
Yep, say more about that.
So when we were in Guantanamo, we would get these court documents. Well, there was a sort of ad hoc court system in place to try the prisoners in the war on terror. And when we get court documents, they'd be subject to all kinds of redactions. So you'd get this piece of paper that looks like a chessboard. It's just got black lines and squares all over the place. And, you know, the argument was that this was a state of heightened national security. And so, you know, we need to make redactions here that otherwise in other cases we wouldn't, and so on and so forth. And I don't think a word of that was ever true, but it established a precedent, right? There's a moment in the book where I talk about Muhammadu Slahi's diary. He was held in Guantanamo for years, and he kept this diary, and eventually it was published. And the first edition of that book went through that censorship process. And there's a scene in that book where he's being interrogated very, very harshly. And there's obviously more than one person in the room, but only certain pronouns are blacked out. And you look closely, and the pronouns that are blacked out are the female pronouns. The censor doesn't want you to know that there was a female soldier in that room. I have a hard time believing that there's a sort of formal national security case to be made in that sense. But every one of these things establishes a precedent. This is how we do this now. And so when you establish legislation against boycotting, for example, you are establishing precedent. And why can't we use this in other cases where somebody is saying something that the state doesn't like? I mean, you generally watch this in slow motion under democratic administrations, but under this present administration, you are going to watch it at a much, much faster speed. All of these precedents that we've allowed to be established are now going to be used across the board. As you and I are speaking, there are migrants being shipped off to Guantanamo Bay, which brings the use of that base full circle, I suppose. But none of this stuff happens if we don't allow those precedents to come into play.
Ellicott's book is One Day Everyone Will Have Always Been Against This. And by this, he means the genocide in Gaza. There are early signs that his title is prescient. The deafening silence from mainstream politicians and pundits about Israel's policy of genocide in Gaza is beginning to break. When people like Congressman Richie Torres, recipient of large donations from the Zionist donor fund AIPAC, start calling for an end to the starvation of Palestinians, it seems like the tide may be turning. I hope so. Today, I read a moving article in the Washington Post about a Palestinian American who, on video calls with her family in Gaza, is watching them starve. I wrote the following in the comments section. Every time I eat something now, I think of the starving people in Gaza, and I'm overcome with guilt that my tax dollars are being used to kill, maim, and starve them. I feel sick and helpless. As a Jew, I'm appalled that this genocide is being committed in my name. I grew up with a slogan, never again, and that always meant never again for anyone. As a Jew, it was drilled into me that being a, quote, chosen people meant that Jews were responsible for fighting for justice for every human being in the world. Now, Israel has betrayed the most fundamental tenets of Judaism and is aping the Nazi perpetrators of the Holocaust. We must all step up to protest this evil and demand a free, just, self-determined Palestine. When I clicked Add Comment, the following message popped up. This comment has been rejected for violating our guidelines. I've never had a comment rejected by the Washington Post. All I can ask is, why is this comment different from all the other comments I made? Maybe it's a mistake, or could it be that the Washington Post algorithm has been designed to suppress opinion decrying the genocide? The problem is, with owner Jeff Bezos currying favor with Donald Trump as he pursues his AI business dreams, it's hard to know. And that's what really scares me. Let me know what you think. Go to @writersvoice.bsky.social to tell me what you think. Next week on Writer's Voice, we talk with the great Honoré Fanon Jeffers about her new book, Misbehaving at the Crossroads, Essays and Writings. Don't miss it. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Listen again for free, check out our archives, and find out more about this week's guests. You can find our social media links there too. And don't forget to subscribe, like, and link to our podcast. It really helps to spread the word about the show. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.